But there is no do-over to casting electoral votes. It has to happen on the same day. That uniformity requirement is written explicitly in the text of the Constitution, and it was significant to the resolution of our most disputed presidential election ever, the Hayes-Tilden election of 1876. So that's part of the constitutional demarcation between the casting process versus the counting process.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 6th, 2021. It is Electoral Count Voting Day. The Proud Boys are descending on Washington, and members of Congress in a joint session will open and count the electoral votes and declare Joe Biden and Kamala Harris the winners of the election. It will not be without controversy, however, as members from both houses plan to object, forcing debate. We're going to have turmoil in the Capitol and turmoil outside the Capitol, and we have a panel to talk about it. We are joined in the virtual jungle studio by Scott Anderson, our senior editor, Molly Reynolds, Brookings and Lawfare congressional guru, and Ned Foley of the Ohio State Moritz College of Law, an election law specialist extraordinaire, to talk about what the rules are for counting electoral votes, how much latitude do they have, what could really happen today, and what role, if any, Mike Pence could play in the disposition of the final stage of the presidential election. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 6th, counting the electoral votes. I want to start, Molly, with a succinct overview from you of what the rules and the law say is going to happen today.
Sure. What the rules and the law say is that at 1 o'clock, the House and Senate will convene in a joint meeting to count the electoral votes. At that point, the vice president or whoever is presiding over the joint meeting, we think it's at this point going to be Vice President Pence, but there is some precedent for it being the Senate President Pro Tem, which would in this case be Chuck Grassley. But that person opens all of the certificates and papers purporting to be certificates. Here I'm quoting from the Electoral Count Act. The tellers, who are two members of the House appointed by the Speaker, two members of the Senate appointed by the President of the Senate. They read those certificates aloud. The Vice President, or the presiding officer, calls for objections to the counting of those certificates. Those objections must be made in writing and signed by at least one House member and at least one senator to be properly lodged. If there is a proper objection, the House and Senate will retire from their joint meeting and reconstitute themselves as their separate chambers for at most 2 hours of debate on that objection. Then they will return to the joint session, at which point the vice president would read the results of what each chamber has decided. And this will sort of continue in alphabetical order of the states from A to Z, if you will, until the process is complete. That's my sort of succinct explanation. I don't know if Scott or Ned think there are any very pertinent details that I've missed.
Yeah, so let's actually give them a chance to do that. Scott and Ned, did Molly miss anything of consequence there?
Not to my thinking. Ned?
No, I thought that was great.
Okay, great. So I want to talk about a metaphysical question of what it means to cast an electoral vote before we go any farther, because I think some people, including the President of the United States, seem a little confused on this point. And I think it's worth pausing, Mr. President, if you're listening, for you, but also for anybody else who's confused. The electoral votes were cast last month on December 14th in the capitals of the several states. They are being counted tomorrow. What is the significance, Ned, of the counting of the electoral votes, and how is it different from the casting of the electoral votes?
Sure. Well, the 12th Amendment to the Constitution does require this special joint session of Congress for the counting, but it is just that. It's counting votes that have been previously cast. And the Constitution, also in Article 2, says that the casting of those votes had to be on the same day in every state in the country. Again, Congress picked the day, and that was December 14. But there is no do-over to casting electoral votes. It has to happen on the same day. That uniformity requirement is written explicitly in the text of the Constitution, and it was significant to the resolution of our most disputed presidential election ever, the Hayes-Tilden election of 1876. So that's part of the constitutional demarcation between the casting process versus the counting process.
Right. And Scott, so there are really three critical points in a presidential election, right? There is the November casting of votes for electors. There is the December casting of electoral votes. And then there is what's happening today, which is the counting of the electoral votes. And so my question to you is, when was Joe Biden elected? Was he elected on November 3rd, the day of the vote? Was he elected on December 14th? Or is he becoming actually formally president-elect today?
Well, before I get to your question, Ben, I want to just add one little nuance to the premise. I think you are right that those are the three main kind of constitutional dates that the constitutional system has set up, that in terms of the process of selecting a president.
I think we're about to hear the word safe harbor deadline.
That's exactly right. Congress has introduced another important date that is equally significant than those dates. And that's 6 days before the December 14th this year, varies year to year, but this year date for counting the electoral votes. And that is the end of the safe harbor period, a period in which the states are allowed to try and resolve any election disputes under their state procedures. And if they do so by the end of that safe harbor period, 6 days before the counting of electoral votes, that determination is given special weight by Congress, or at least supposed to be given special weight by Congress under the Electoral Count Act, the statute that was enacted in the 1880s, given special weight when Congress actually sits and counts the votes. What I would say, although I think there are different views and Ned and Molly may disagree, is that Vice President Biden becomes the constitutional president-elect on January 6th when the electoral votes are counted. That's the point at the end of that special process established by the 12th Amendment. That's the point at where he becomes the person who becomes president on January 20th after President Trump's term ends. Before that, he is in many ways still a president-elect. He's certainly a statutory president-elect. That's that statute we saw the Office of Management and Budget wrestling with, saying, well, who is the president-elect and who actually is entitled to these different resources provided for transition, this access by Congress, by statute. In a lot of ways, he is certainly the president-elect in the popular imagination. In most years, most cases, the vast majority of cases, it'll be clear who the constitutional president-elect is going to be as early as maybe election night, certainly as early as the electors casting their votes. But because there are processes that are still in play that can change the outcome and at least some circumstances, it's not until really January 6th, that final counting date, again, and that date can shift a little bit year to year, but this year is January 6th. That is the day at the end of that process, when we know who becomes president January 20th. So I would say that's the day when he becomes the constitutional president-elect. Kamala Harris becomes the constitutional vice president-elect.
Molly, Ned, do either of you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with Scott's characterization of the kind of notion of the constitutional president-elect and the fact that that is what Joe Biden becomes at the completion of the counting of the electoral votes by Congress. I do think as a kind of political matter, he becomes the president-elect much earlier. And Scott got into this a little bit in his discussion of the transition. But certainly in terms of how we and how you know, average Americans think about the transition of power and our democratic decision-making process. I think it is important to acknowledge that, you know, on election day in November, when millions of people went to the polls after millions of other people had submitted their ballots in other ways as well, that as a kind of political matter is when the question was settled.
And my answer, I think, is a little bit different in focusing on the Constitution. I think on December 14, the electors in the various states did elect Biden the president. And in that sense, in a sense, he became president-elect under the Constitution on December 14. But I do think the January 6th, meeting tomorrow is also constitutionally significant in that it is Congress's official confirmation and declaration of that status, which is a key part of the process. So, I mean, and it's frustrating that there is this kind of ambiguity or different ways of talking about it. But, I think actually Senator McConnell had it quite right in his thinking that the right time for him to acknowledge Vice President Biden as president-elect was after the Electoral College meeting, and that was decisive. We have to realize that these separate dates were set up, in the 19th century at a time of different communication and transportation. And therefore, it was important that those procedures go from the state capitals, Ben, as you said, to Washington to get from the Electoral College votes of the electors to the congressional counting and recognition of those votes. In the modern world, I think it's easier for us to say that once the electors cast their ballots on December 14th, and we saw that on C-SPAN and know that we know the result, and that the congressional confirmation tomorrow is a confirmation of what legally was dispositive on the 14th. Now, to Molly's point about the political culture, I do think we've come to be accustomed, given the nature of the popular vote that occurs in November, to treat the winner of the popular vote when it becomes apparent to us, as the functional equivalent of being a president-elect, because at the Electoral College meeting in December will simply confirm the popular vote. But a constitutional purist would say it's the December 14 date which is the presidential election and produces an elected president.
So I'm inclined to agree with Ned on this. And the reason I belabor the point by asking you all to walk through it is that the president of the United States picked up the phone this weekend and called the Secretary of State of Georgia, and as we all know, asked him to find 11,000, et cetera, more votes in Georgia by way of flipping the state. And the point that I want to get to is that actually we're not gathering in Washington in Congress for a joint session of Congress to count the votes in Georgia right now. We're gathering to count the electoral votes, which were cast and have been sent to Congress. And so am I wrong that whether you think of it in the way that Scott is describing or the way that Ned is describing, the ship that the president is trying to sink here has really already sailed, right?
Absolutely. That, I think, is absolutely the correct view. And that's the fundamental misunderstanding that both President Trump has. And frankly, Senators Hawley and Cruz, I believe, they are misunderstood in the same way.
I tend to agree to that entirely. The one point I would just add to go back to say why I do think this January 6th date is still significant and why we need to still be vigilant about efforts to disrupt it is that this is where the 12th Amendment has the line, shall be the president, right? It is after this process. If this process isn't completed with some semblance of the constitutional requirements, I don't believe that the people who are elected on December 14th will actually become the president on January 20th. Maybe I'm wrong about that, and Ned and Molly are welcome to disagree with me, but that's why there's still such a step. That's what, in my mind at least, why the constitutional president-elect line is crossed on January 6th. Now, that doesn't mean that anything goes up until January 6th. There are lots of other legal requirements and legal obligations that go into the process prior to that date And those are the things that really restrain and have sailed the ship, if you will, that President Trump is trying to get on here a little bit late.
But Scott, just to make clear that on this, what I think is the salient point, we are all in agreement. You don't disagree. Imagine that, you know, the Georgia Secretary of State, Raffensperger, had been a person of less integrity than he was, and he'd taken the call and said, "Mr. President, yes, I can find you those. I can find you 12,000 votes to put you over the top," and had gone out the next day and announced, "Look, under my desk, I found 12,000 votes, and actually, President Trump won Georgia." That would actually, except in a political sense, not affect what is going to happen today, right? Because the electoral votes were cast. There is no competing slate of electors. The electoral votes were cast in Georgia on December 14th. They were cast for Biden. And the only role for Congress now is to decide whether or not to count them, which under the Electoral Count Act, they are at least notionally obliged to do. Do you agree with that?
I actually don't entirely. I do entirely in this scenario. I think the key point to bear in mind, though, is that in terms of the institutional role that's being fulfilled right now, is that Congress still has what is in some factual scenarios a substantive role to play. If you think back in 1961, in a debate over electoral votes cast by the slate of electors from the state of Hawaii, they actually had a certification from a governor in place by the casting of electoral votes. And then they still had state law proceedings ongoing, issuing a recount that actually wasn't completed until December after the casting of electoral votes that ultimately determined that the other party won that election. And the way that Congress ended up handling that situation is that they decided by unanimous consent to agree to accept the electoral votes that were cast by the people who were found by the judicial process by the led by the state court under the recount to have won by the Democrats, not the Republicans, who were originally thought to have won. But Congress played kind of a decisive role in recognizing that last slate. I'm actually not 100% sure that that actually was the right slate, that if you were to apply the Electoral Count Act straight on its terms, was the one that should have been counted. But Congress decided these are the ones we're going to count, and it was unanimous, so it passed whatever threshold was necessary. So there is still a substantive role for Congress to play. The problem here is that there's just no reasonable or lawful basis for them to play any role to upset the results of the election. But I just don't think that people should treat this thing as a fait accompli entirely or as a step that is without any actual substantive significance, because there is still a legal significance of what happens tomorrow, certainly in other scenarios. And even in this scenario, opportunities to disrupt it may well still exist. That should still be concerning. We need to be aware of and keep an eye on.
All right. And Scott has just given the game away. Yes, we recorded this yesterday on Tuesday, not in real time on early Wednesday morning. All right. With that, let's talk about what specifically is likely to happen today. So Molly has given us a kind of overview of the rules. We've discussed the theoretical and legal possibility of Congress playing a substantive role. Molly, I take it you don't think this is going to happen in anything other than a theatrical manner. And my question is, how confident are you of that and why?
So I'm pretty confident that it is just going to be kind of an extended exercise of procedural theater. And this goes back a little bit to what we were talking about before about the role of Congress here. Even if it is quote unquote just theater, it's still troubling in some important ways because of what it says to the broader public about whether they should have confidence in our elections. So, you know, if Republican members of the House and the Senate, as we're expecting, are going to take to the floors of their respective chambers and make false claims about what happened during the election, and that's going to be on television, it's going to be in the congressional record, that sends really problematic, to my mind, signals about the health of our democracy. But again, as I both Scott and Ned have said, my assessment of kind of where we end up is that we will eventually get through all of the states. It may take quite some time. So I mentioned when I was going over the rules is that if there is a properly lodged objection, and by that I mean it's been signed by at least one member of the House and at least one member of the House and the Senate have to dissolve from the joint session and resolve into their separate bodies to have debate over that objection and vote on the objection. The debate on the objection is limited to 2 hours, but if folks choose to object to a number of states, that could take quite some time. And then we also add in the time for them to physically separate from the joint session and reconstitute. We add in extra time, hopefully, for extended voting to allow for physical distancing per COVID protocols. And this could be a many hour exercise. I do think that because one of the states that folks are focusing on is Arizona, which comes relatively early in the alphabet, we are likely to know something about kind of strategy and where the objectors might be trying to take things relatively early on in the session. But I really do think it could extend for many hours. You know, we've sometimes seen pictures of the Senate in particular bringing out the cots for all-night filibusters. I mean, I think we could be in for that sort of thing.
And just to be clear about what we do and don't know, do we know how many states the objectors are likely to object to? Is it going to be do a formal objection on Georgia, have a bunch of speeches, and then go home? Or is it going to be like each of the 5 battleground states, you object to all of them and redo 2 hours, up to 2 hours of debate for each one?
So I don't think we know that, certainly not at the time that we're having this conversation. And part of this is because you have a group of House members, potentially, frankly, a quite large, troublingly large group of Republican House members who are plotting strategy in the House. And then in the Senate, you have sort of 2 different efforts. There's the kind of Ted Cruz-led effort, and then there's Josh Hawley, who seems to be operating somewhat separately from a more cohesive group of Republican senators. And I think the House members and the senators may have different strategies. They certainly have leaders who have taken somewhat different positions on what should happen. McConnell has been much less publicly encouraging than I think Kevin McCarthy in the House has. House members, I think, are pushing for objections to up to 6 states, Arizona, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nevada. Reporting from today suggests that kind of the Cruz-led group of senators are focusing principally on Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. But I think it's just hard to know exactly what will unfold.
Ned, what are you expecting realistically tomorrow? Do you think this is headed to a, cots on the floor situation, which, by the way, from a COVID point of view, is a terrible idea? Or are you expecting a more pro forma, state the objections so that you can claim to have done so and then get out of the way?
I guess I'm expecting the cots on the floor situation, that it'll go late into the night and into Thursday. But that's guess. I think I'm with Molly that we just don't know. And it does depend on how many states get a senator objecting. I mean, I think if the House objectors had their way, they would object to all of the states that are under consideration. But we may get only limited objections on the Senate side. And of course, without that senator on board for any given state, it doesn't go anywhere. So that's the big wild card. If I could go back to the conversation that you, Ben, and Scott were having, which I think is really important, what I would add to that is I think the Electoral Count Act both has a substantive side of its analysis and a procedural side. And Ben, I think you were right on substance, and I think Scott was right on procedure. And I think this is relevant to understanding what the natures of these objections are. An objection that is signed by a senator as well as a representative is procedurally cognizable and must be taken up, regardless of its substantive validity. And that's what can force these 2 hours of debate. This is what happened over the 2004 election when Senator Barbara Boxer, you know, joined a colleague from the House and forced this process. So that's in conformity to the procedural rules. And it does mean that the Congress has a role to play the way that Scott talked about. And we can come back to, you know, the Hawaii in the 1960 election example. But my own view is that the objection that was lodged over the 2004 election by Senator Barbara Boxer was substantively incorrect under the rules of the Electoral Count Act itself and the safe harbor provision that we were all talking about earlier. Ohio's electoral votes from 2004 had safe harbor status, and the statute says Congress is supposed to treat that as conclusive, as a final determination of the appointment of electors. That's binding on Congress and all members of Congress, including Senator Boxer. And so while her objection was procedurally cognizable, it was substantively inappropriate. And that's how I view what Senator Hawley and Senator Cruz are proposing. And it goes, Ben, to your point about how to understand, you know, the difference of what happened in the states in December. You know, Georgia, to use the example that you made, they have appointed their electors. Did they make a mistake in counting their popular vote? You know, probably not. They did it three times. Well, they did make a mistake. Their recount discovered, you know, a significant error of about 1,000 votes, but they corrected it. There wasn't a mistake in, you know, the winner of the popular vote that determined the appointment of the electors. But as you said, Ben, you know, that ship has sailed. We know who the official electors from the state of Georgia are. That's the only question that comes to Congress. Substantively, you know, were Congress to deviate from that conclusion, it may be procedurally capable of doing so, but it doesn't make it substantively correct. And as I think Scott acknowledged, you know, Congress exercised some power that it had in the 1960 election over the Hawaii submissions and got away with it, if you will. It counted Hawaii's votes for Kennedy. But that result was, in fact, exactly the opposite of the constitutional principle that was relied upon in the Hayes-Tilden dispute. The reason why Hayes prevailed and Tilden lost was because the Electoral Commission that Congress set up in the deciding vote from Justice Joseph Bradley, who was the so-called tie-breaking member of the 15-member commission, being a justice of the Supreme Court, he wrote an opinion. He was sitting in his capacity as a commissioner, but he explained why he ruled in favor of Hayes and against Tilden. And his basis for his decision was that nothing can happen in a state after the electors have met and cast their vote. The Florida legislature back in 1876 attempted to do a recount after the electors had already met. And in fact, like Hawaii in 1960, the Florida recount showed that Tilden had won the popular vote, not Hayes, as originally counted. And Justice Bradley said, that's too late. If you had had a recount earlier and corrected it, of course that would have been cognizable before you appoint your electors and before they cast their votes. But once electors are appointed and once electors cast their votes, it's constitutionally finished because of this uniformity requirement that happened on the same day in all the states. So given that principle, Hawaii was actually counted incorrectly. Now, that happened by unanimous consent, and it didn't matter to the overall Electoral College outcome. And Vice President Nixon at the time was careful to say they weren't making a precedent. But I think all of that, I know it's complicated, but it shows the distinctions between the procedural side of the process and the substantive principles that are supposed to guide the process.
So is it fair to say, can I get you both to agree on the following formulation, that if Congress is united on the subject, it is capable of doing what it wants in counting the votes, whether or not the law answers the question of which votes should and should not be counted? Is that fair? Like if there were uniform desire in Congress to not count, you know, the votes from Georgia, notwithstanding that they were validly cast under Georgia law on December 14th, Congress could do it, but that doesn't answer the question of what the rules say should happen.
Yes, that's my understanding. Congress, the two chambers in concert can get away, if you will, with what they both want. And the rules of the statute allow for that disposition, and it would be controlling, but it wouldn't be substantively appropriate for them to do what they, because they've said that they're supposed to only count the votes that have safe harbor status. So that's what they're supposed to do. Now, if both chambers agree to discard a submission that has safe harbor status and be in willful defiance of their own rules, the statute also says in a separate provision that what the two chambers agree to do will prevail. So both halves of the are correct. They're just different halves of the process. And that's in my analysis.
Scott, do you agree with that?
I think so. But I think it reflects one of the fundamental aspects of this that plays into it, which is that Congress tends to be its own judge in most of these decisions, as far as we can tell. And our kind of operating assumption is that Congress has a lot of discretion. It's pretty unlikely courts are going to step in and start fuddling with how they approach their duty to count these votes. Well, I don't think we 100% know that necessarily. It seems like that's most consistent with how the court generally thinks about its roles and these sorts of authorities. But it's possible that they might be appropriate in some hypothetical scenario. But because the assumption is that Congress has a lot of this leeway in exercising this authority, the question becomes, well, how seriously does it take its own obligations on, as Ned has described, the substantive obligations, the rules that it's set up for itself? And that's the difficult question. You know, it kind of comes down, kind of like the impeachment case that we spent so much time talking about towards the end of last year, beginning of this year. It comes down to how legislators conceive of their own duty, how they conceive of the law. And it is sometimes difficult, in my mind, to separate substance, the legal substance, and people's political views, and which is why the procedural elements sometimes tend to rise to the fore, at least in my mind, as the things that are the real legal obstacles to navigate around. But I take Ned's point. I totally agree. I mean, there's right and wrong. There are rules that Congress has set out for itself. But I'm not sure that doesn't mean that if Congress didn't want to, it couldn't override those rules and reach a contrary outcome. It's in a lot of cases, maybe not all.
I think this is a really important, interesting conversation. What I think we should probably come back to at this point is the notion that what is going to happen when the House and the Senate count these votes this year is that we'll get to the end of the process and the votes will have been counted in favor of Joe Biden. But that doesn't mean that it won't be ugly procedurally, politically, both of those things together along the way in a way that, again, as I mentioned before, is troubling for the state of our democracy and our democratic process and what it says about what elected officials are willing to tell the public about how they think the election happened.
And Molly, just to be clear, your prediction on that score is based on the fact that not only is there not unanimous consent in both houses to change the electoral or to discard electoral votes, but there is a majority of both houses that is clearly going to defer to these electoral votes as reported by the states. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, obviously the Democrats have a majority in the House. And then if we sort of do the math in the Senate, we have the Democrats plus a sufficient number of Republicans who have said that they will abide by the votes as cast by the electors in December.
And how many Republicans of that variety are there? It's quite a few at this point, right?
It is. I don't have the count off the top of my head. But I mean, a big part of kind of why Mitch McConnell has been a little bit cagey about all of this publicly, and I think reporting suggests within his conference as well, is because, you know, forcing some of these Republican senators to cast a vote on this question is, in addition to being substantively problematic, that, you know, the voters cast their votes, they were properly counted in the states, the electors cast their votes, and now the Congress's role is to count those electoral college returns. There's a political challenge for some of these Republican senators as well. And so I think that particularly ones who are perhaps up for re-election themselves in 2022 and So I just think that, I don't know what the number is, but I do think that we should expect to see a decent number of Senate Republicans vote against objections to counting the properly cast Electoral College votes.
I'm looking at a Washington Post webpage, which as of 9:42 a.m. on January 5th is reporting that 22 Republican senators are supporting essentially the electoral votes for Joe Biden, and 13 opposed certification with 16 unclear. So, you know, I can't vouch for the reporting that leads to those numbers, but I found that actually a useful page to bookmark on my web browser.
All right, there's one big variable that we haven't yet discussed, and his name is Mike Pence. The president has said at a rally in Georgia that he thinks Mike Pence will, you know, they're counting on him to do the right thing, and that he's a great guy, but he'll like him a little bit less if he doesn't come through for us. I think that's pretty close to a quote. And this, of course, has raised the question in a lot of people's minds, what can Mike Pence do? So, Scott, get us started on this. If you're Mike Pence and you want to do everything you can for Donald Trump, how much latitude do you have sitting there in the chair presiding over the Senate as it counts votes under the rules as you guys have articulated them?
Well, the Electoral Count Act, the statute from the 1880s we keep referring back to, really makes a very deliberate effort to reduce the role of the vice president in his roles as president of the Senate in this counting process. You know, he essentially is responsible for receiving and taking in electoral slates that are received. He may be able to exercise some discretion in bringing forward which ones to bring forward and kind of present for debate. That's one area he has some authority, so he could choose to bring forward, for example, or seems most likely to be able to choose to bring forward. I think there's still a little doubt about that. But in most views, the alternative slates that are cast by Republican electors into these disputed states like Pennsylvania and Georgia. But at that point, really, he's supposed to open them up and hand them to tellers who actually do most of the work of counting and reading and approaching this sort of process. As chair of the session, he has some basic procedural duties, it seems. You know, he is the one who is supposed to be hearing motions and, you know, refusing to hear motions, particularly that don't meet the requirement, which at least under precedent says essentially that the only motion that you're supposed to be able to entertain on the floor would be something to say that the two chambers should separate and debate a given question. And only then, even then, only if you get a motion signed by both member of the Senate and the member of the House. At least that's the way that Vice President Al Gore interpreted the rules and applied them in 2001 while overseeing the counting of the 2000 election results and electoral votes. So his rules should be particularly constrained. And certainly if he's applying those sorts of precedents, it's constrained. The one other thing I suppose
he can do. But wait a minute. I want to focus on one thing that you'd said that I did not know, which is that he could bring up fake slates of electors from Georgia that aren't certified by the governor and force, say, Democrats to object rather than the Republicans who want to object to the actual Georgia electors?
Well, the language, and I'll welcome Ned and Molly, you can weigh in on this, because I don't think there's a lot of clarity exactly how this works or if it's the degree to which there's a legal precedent versus kind of the way it's been approached by prior vice presidents. But the language of 3 U.S.C. 15 is from the Electoral Count Act says essentially that all the certificates and papers purporting to be certificates of electoral votes are what's being brought forward and considered here. So I think that means he has some ability, although I also think there's kind of an assumption that insofar as there are prank slates being submitted, that there's also some sort of winnowing the vice president can do. The National Archives appears to be doing that as well, because they only really seem to be posting or counting the official slates of electors to be brought forward. But I think there's at least a substantial potential for the vice president to be able to say, oh, yeah, we are actually going to have a debate over both of these slates of electors. I don't think he can, you know, essentially hold back the official one, insofar as it clearly has been received both by the National Archives and by the vice president, but you may be able to introduce another one. And remember, the Electoral Count Act, one of the main fact scenarios it's intended to address is when you have multiple slates of electoral votes
right.
from a given state, And then there are default rules for establishing which one you actually end up counting based on compliance with the safe harbor. And then if that doesn't decide the matter based on, you know, which one's signed by the state executive, other factors along those lines spelled out in statute. So there's a little bit of ability to affect the proceedings there, but I doubt it's determinative in any way in the current fact pattern, at least.
All right. So Ned and Molly, if you were Mike Pence and bent on using this opportunity to show as much loyalty and fervor for Donald Trump as you could by way of maintaining your own political viability in the Trumpist world, what plays do you see that Scott hasn't mentioned?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to entertain the hypothetical. I do think it will remain hypothetical and should do so, because it would be essentially to go rogue or to be lawless. And I don't think it could succeed, but it would make it messier. So I think the most Trumpian move, if you will, that the presiding officer, presumably Pence, could make would be, I think, to attempt to disqualify electoral votes. So we, as Molly said, we think Arizona is going to come up first in terms of anything under dispute. And so, and to pick up on Scott's point, the vice president could announce, I'm in possession of, you know, two submissions from the state of Arizona. We think that's going to be the case. We're not 100% sure at this point, but we've been told by the putative electors on the Republican side from Arizona who joined the lawsuit filed by Representative Gohmert that they have submitted their alternative electoral votes. So we have to believe that they've arrived in Pence's office, and the language that Scott mentions about any papers purporting to be electoral votes, that would allow Pence to show them to the joint session. So what if he says, I've got these two submissions, who knows what really happened in Arizona? I propose that we disqualify both submissions and simply treat Arizona as having failed to appoint electors that Congress can count votes from. You know, that would immediately provoke objections. But as Ben, you said, that the objections then would have to come from the Democratic side. And eventually, you know, the ruling of the chair or the proposal for the chair would be overruled because both chambers would disagree with that proposal. But that's, I think, the ugliest of how this possibly could go forward.
Molly, do you have any further suggestions for Mike Pence on this score?
I don't.
We should call this this episode Help Mike Pence Erode Democracy.
I do think to pick up on one point that Ned was making, that if we do get into kind of even more unprecedented procedural territory than some of what we've been talking about, we would get to the point, I think, where it would matter a fair amount sort of how the objections are, how they're formulated, and what question is actually being put to each chamber. So it would matter, for example, like what Pence himself rules from the chair, because then it matters what you're trying to overturn in a vote of each chamber. But I don't have other suggestions for how to make this go even more off the rails than we've already contemplated.
Finally, I want to ask you all about one atmospheric matter, which is that there is going to be a large-scale demonstration going on outside. Trump supporters from all over the place are going to be coming in, are promising to bring weapons in a fashion that, of course, violates DC law, and the possibility of violence is not trivial. To what extent do you think the conditions outside of the Capitol are likely to inflect the conditions inside?
So to kind of zoom out just a little bit from that specific question, and to go back to what I was talking about before in terms of the uncertainty about how all of this will unfold, I think one of the reasons why I have so much uncertainty is because it's just hard to know how different factions, particularly within the Republican Party, will respond to each other as the day unfolds. So could it be the case that there is a large-scale mass mobilization in D.C., and that makes this, particularly the group of House Republicans who have really dug in their heels on this, make them more willing to push multiple objections? I don't know. I think that's possible. It's also possible that, you know, what House members are doing eggs on certain senators, or that senators get tired of having to keep reconvening to debate these objections. So I do think that that's another reason why there is some uncertainty for me about how things will unfold, because it's just difficult to know what those outside the building circumstances, how members inside the building will respond. I will say that reporting suggests that members themselves, particularly on the House side, have been told to be very cautious in terms of their own personal safety as part of this, that they should arrive at the Capitol complex quite early in the day, several hours before the vote counting actually begins, that they should use the tunnels that connect the buildings in the Capitol complex rather than going outside. So it suggests to me that the Capitol Police and the folks responsible for physical security of the members themselves have some of these concerns about what could be unfolding outside the building.
We're going to leave it there. Molly Reynolds, Ned Foley, Scott Anderson, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Zachary Frank of the Goat Rodeo firm. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Share us on Facebook, tweet us on Twitter, pin us on Pinterest. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for listening.